wouldn't you like to be a whale and sail serenely by? An 80-foot whale from the tip to your tail and a tiny briny eye. Wouldn't you like to wallow where nobody says come out? Wouldn't you like to swallow and blow all the brine about?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you like to be so clean and never have to wash, I mean? Wouldn't you like to spout? Oh, yes, just think. Then a feather of spray sailing away, rising and sinking and sinking and rising and blowing the brine about.
Oh, whales go sailing over the bounding main.
From Arctic snow to Mexico and then back home again.
Whales go sailing over the bounding main, wherever they please on seven seas, and then back home again.
Wouldn't you like to be a whale and sail serenely by? An 80-foot whale from the tip to your tail and a tiny briny eye. Wouldn't you like to wallow where nobody says come out? And wouldn't you like to swallow and blow all the brine about?
Yeah!
Wouldn't you like to be so clean
and never have to wash, I mean?
Wouldn't you love to spout? No doubt, no.
And a feather of spray sailing away, rising and sinking and sinking and rising and blowing the brine about.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener supported community radio.
I heard the song.
For the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. We opened with Hoagie Carmichael performing the Whale Song. I'm Susan Trudy.
And I'm Stephen Trudy. Our guest tonight is Douglas Carlton Abrams. He's author of a new novel called The Eye of the Whale. It's an eco-adventure story that focuses on the dangers to the whale population through hunting and through ocean pollution. In researching the novel, Doug investigated problems facing the whale population, and we'll talk with him about what he discovered.
Ecotopia is made possible in part by member contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer cartridge refilling and remanufacturing for a green community. The Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-Counties Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333.
And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll take a short break and then be back with some background information on current threats to whales.
Love the world's last whale as it rocked in the moonlight and reefed the sail. It'll happen to you also without fail, if it happens to me, sang the world's last whale. It was down off Bermuda early last spring, near an underwater mountain where the humpbacks sing. I lowered the microphone about a quarter mile down, switched on the recorder, let the tape spin round. I didn't just hear grunting, I didn't just hear squeaks, I didn't just hear bellows, I didn't just hear shrieks. It was the musical singing and the passionate wail came from the heart of the world's last whale. Down in the Antarctic, there the harpoons wait. But it's upon land you decide my fate. In London town, there'll be telling the tale if it's life or death for the world's last whale. So here's a little test to see how you feel. Here's a little test for this age of the automobile. If we can save our singers up in the sea, perhaps there's a chance to save you and me. I heard the song of the world's last whale.
That is Pete Seeger singing the song of the world's last whale from his album At 89. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and our topic is saving the whales. We'll read some alarming headlines compiled by Ashley Anderson, publicist for Doug Abrams, with whom we'll be talking shortly.
Headline: a beached whale in Seattle garnered headlines in April 2010 because its stomach was full of plastic and beach towels.
Beluga whales in the remote Hudson Bay are so filled with industrial chemicals, including plasticizers, that they must be treated like toxic waste when their dead bodies wash up on shore.
Congressman Jim Moran of Northern Virginia and Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts have introduced the Endocrine Disruption Prevention Act to explore linkages between hormone-disrupting chemicals in the environment and everyday goods and the dramatic increase of autism, hyperactivity, diabetes, obesity, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and other hormone-related disorders.
Childhood cancer is up by 26%, making cancer the greatest threat to children.
One in three women will develop cancer. One in two men will develop cancer.
Male fish across the country are developing eggs.
Time magazine recently published a feature article, The Perils of Plastic, investigating endocrine-disrupting chemicals found in everyday products.
The connections among those various headlines about whales and people will become clearer later in the show.
In more positive news, the National Resources Defense Council reported in late June that efforts to rescind the 1986 ban on commercial whaling have been thwarted, at least temporarily. They write, in a move welcomed by conservationists and pro-whale countries around the world, the International Whaling Commission announced that it would postpone a compromise proposal that would have legalized commercial whaling. This move is a dramatic turnaround from years of secret, closed-door negotiations that led to the compromise proposal, a proposal that would have sacrificed a quarter-century-old ban on commercial whaling in an attempt to rein in Japan, Iceland, and Norway's annual killings. The National Resources Defense Council believes that the whaling moratorium is one of the 20th century's most iconic conservation victories. It has saved hundreds of thousands of whales since it took effect in 1986.
Taryn Kekau is the staff attorney with the National Resources Defense Council and their Marine Mammal Protection Program. She said, I'm cautiously optimistic. If the pro-whaling compromise is indeed off the table, that will be a huge victory for the whales against terrific odds. The commission tasked with protecting these mammals has shown great leadership by refusing to adopt a proposal that could have led to the extinction of some already endangered and threatened species. Still, she continues, it is not enough that the decision is delayed. The International Whaling Commission must reaffirm its dedication to the preservation and protection of whales around the world. Now is the time to push for the conservation of whales without trading away the moratorium. Every day, marine animals face new attacks from entanglement, ship strikes, and pollution. it was reckless for the commission to even consider sanctioning their slaughter at this time.
Even so, NRDC reports that Japan, Iceland, and Norway have killed roughly 35,000 whales since the moratorium was introduced in 1986. In Japan's case, the killings have been justified under the guise of scientific research, and that's a theme taken up in Doug Abrams' novel, The Eye of the Whale. Prior to the 1986 whaling moratorium, roughly 38,000 whales were killed annually, that between 1945 and 1986, compared with an average of only, relatively small, 1,240 whales killed per year after the moratorium.
We'll be back with Doug Abrams, author of The Eye of the Whale, right after this. Song of the Whale, Part 1, From Dawn, by Tangerine Dream, from their album Under Sunlight. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight our topic is oceans, their health, and the health of the creatures that swim in them. Listeners may recall that 2 weeks ago, we talked with Skipper Jo Royal of the Plastiki about her concern for plastic pollution in the seas. And then some months back, we also talked with Simon Avery, who is a pilot on one of the Sea Shepherd boats, and the Sea Shepherd's efforts to stop illegal Japanese whaling.
Our guest tonight offers insights into these concerns and more. He's Douglas Carlton Abrams, and he's written a novel called Eye of the Whale. It's a suspense novel. It's a page-turner centered on saving a stranded whale in the Sacramento Delta. It's also research-based and serves as a serious warning not only about the whales, but about human health in an increasingly polluted world. Welcome, Doug Abrams.
Great to be here with you both, Susan.
Thank you.
Stephen.
We thought we'd ask you to read a little bit from the novel first. Perhaps you could set the scene and give the readers a sense of the eye of the whale and how your novel works.
Sure. Well, The Eye of the Whale is an eco-thriller, and right now, the scene I'm going to read that is from Chapter 2, and Elizabeth McKay, who's a marine biologist who's trying to crack the code of humpback whale communication, witnesses something that no other researcher has witnessed, which is the birth of a humpback whale. And I'm going to take your listeners into that birth, and we'll watch it unfold with Elizabeth. I should say that name of brevity, I've tried to abbreviate the chapter somewhat, there's a fuller description in the book.
Right.
The female humpback was in the process of giving birth. A tail, its tips curled over, was beginning to emerge. Elizabeth could not believe that she would be fortunate enough to witness a birth, let alone film it. No researcher had ever seen what she was about to record on film. In her shock, she had forgotten about breathing until her deflated chest began to ache. Kicking gently to the surface, she blew water out of her snorkel and gasped for air. The whole time, she continued looking down and pointing the camera at the female. She was not going to miss this for the world. Elizabeth let out more air from her lungs and silently descended again. Another gasp of bubbles escaped as she recognized the notch missing from the female's tail. It was sliver. She had seen sliver several times over the course of her research, and now she felt like a midwife invited into the intimacy of the whale's birth. Sliver was contracting her abdomen, trying to squeeze out the baby, just like any other mammalian mother. At last, the rest of the 10-foot black body was born in a cloud of tissue and pink-tinged fluid. The calf had large fetal folds, creases caused by the cramped confines of the womb, which made the newborn look like it was made out of origami.
Mm-hmm.
Sliver swam to the baby and nudged it with her head. The baby responded to its mother with a weak nod, but something was wrong. It was not dead, but without the movement of its fins to keep it buoyant, the baby continued to descend. Sliver responded more urgently. She swam under her sinking baby, supported it across her head, and carried it to the surface forcefully. Her massive body created a current of water that pushed Elizabeth away. Elizabeth's eyes were wide as she held her head above the water, waiting. She saw the two adult blows, but no breath from the baby draped across its mother's back. What's wrong, she wondered. Was this baby in distress? Had it been born prematurely? Had it been a prolonged birth? She swam toward the calf, wanting to help it live. But how? As they all bobbed above the surface, the calf's small blowhole caught her eye. It was slack. Elizabeth had an idea. It was crazy, but if it worked, it could save the calf's life. Elizabeth flipped onto her back and began to propel herself with her fins back to Milton's wooden boat. Open the first aid kit, she shouted as she reached the boat and hoisted her video camera onto the bench. You hurt? No, just give me the case. There was no time to explain. Blood into water, Milton said as he handed her the first aid kit. Elizabeth pried open the hard plastic tabs and grabbed the pack of pre-filled hypodermic needles. There were four twin jet pens, each calibrated for two doses. Not enough for the calf's body weight, but dosing of epinephrine was not an exact science, and she had no alternative. The calf's muscles, including its heart, were not responding to life. The baby's whole body was shutting down. The cardiac stimulant in her hand was the only hope. Listen for the horn, Milton said, holding the air horn in his hand. It was their signal to alert her if he saw sharks. Elizabeth's flippers propelled her forward quickly, and she twisted her body rhythmically to increase her speed. As she approached the whales, she tried to stay focused, but her eyes were drawn to the edges of her mask, scanning for sharks. Bruff! Elizabeth froze. Sliver's protective underwater blow was unmistakable, as was the screen of bubbles. Elizabeth knew not to challenge a 35-ton female driven by the strongest of instincts, protection of her young. Elizabeth looked into Sliver's eye. The sclera was bulging, and it showed an anxious ring of white. Of course she's stressed, Elizabeth thought, and tried to calm her breath as she swam forward slowly. The baby could die at any moment from lack of oxygen. Elizabeth approached cautiously, looking for any further sign of agitation or aggression. One swipe of Sliver's tail or flipper could kill her instantly. Elizabeth kicked her fins slowly, approaching. A moment later, she reached out and touched the soft skin of the baby whale. She placed her finger in one of the smooth nostrils of the blowhole, but it did not close reflexively. She could hear the strained rumbling of its breath. The calf was trying to live. Elizabeth moved down the body of the young whale toward the tail that was draped over its mother. The calf's smooth skin felt like a shelled, hard-boiled egg. Elizabeth noted several lesions, which surprised her. How could the calf have gotten lesions in its mother's womb? Elizabeth quickly removed the plastic cap of one twin jet and wrapped her fist around the pen, jabbing it into the vein all the way up to the hub. The spring-loaded needle shot into the whale's body. No response. She clutched another pen and punched it into the vein. Still no response. Elizabeth's limp snorkel hung next to her face as she kicked with her feet to stay next to the whale's drifting body. Despite its size, the calf seemed so fragile. Sliver began to sink so that only a small part of the calf's back floated above the surface. Elizabeth would need to make the next injection underwater. She bit down on the hard plastic mouthpiece of her snorkel and felt for the veins as she ducked her head beneath the surface. She injected a third pen. Still nothing. Elizabeth looked at the final pen in her fist and then felt for the vein with the fingertips of her other hand. She pounded against the whale's sloughing skin. The pen fired and the epinephrine shot into the vein. Breathe, damn it, breathe! The calf's desperate gasp was fast and sharp as the blowhole opened wide. The baby's entire body seemed to convulse with the desire to live as it arched its back, lifted its flukes, and started throwing its head and tail to the side spasmodically. As Elizabeth kicked backward quickly to avoid being hit by 1,500 pounds of newborn awkwardness, she heard a sputtering sound and then saw a tiny blow. The baby, still stimulated from the injection, rolled off its mother and started to beat its tail up and down eagerly. Elizabeth laughed with relief, and her chest swelled with joy as she saw the two 15-foot blows, followed by the 6-foot blow from the calf. Its burst of vapor was an explosion of hope and survival. The three whales dove, the baby following the lead of its mother and escort. Elizabeth scanned the pattern on its tail, trying to memorize it. She noticed four very faint parallel lines on the left side and remembered the four injections. She'd call the calf Fourth Chance.
Wow.
Excellent. Thank you.
It's an amazing scene. Amazing scene.
Thank you. Thank you.
So the eye of the whale is what you call back-based fiction.
Yes.
Can you tell us what that is and how you came to write such a novel and how you came to write about whales?
Absolutely. Well, fact-based fiction is fiction that is constrained and liberated by what we know about the world, about what science tells us is happening in our world. And as an eco-thriller, this is a story about the struggle between humanity and nature, but which is kind of one of the oldest stories that we tell.
Mm-hmm.
But in the past, it's typically those stories in which humanity was at the mercy of nature, and increasingly our eco-thrillers remind us that it's nature that's at the mercy of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so this novel, it began... I mean, I've loved whales since I grew up as a young boy on the East Coast and spent time in Nantucket, a block from the Whaling Museum, actually.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And learned about whales and their majesty and the ways in which they really, I think, are kind of the embodiment of the ocean and the voice of the deep. And so... this particular story, though, was launched because I was reading to my twin daughters by the fire one cold winter morning a story about a whale that swam up the Sacramento that you
mm-hmm.
may remember, Humphrey.
Humphrey. Mm-hmm.
And so there was at the time that the whale had also swam up the Thames in London.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine was visiting, and she was telling me about some new environmental dangers of what was happening to our children that I had not heard of. And the story question that launched this book was, what if what was happening in the ocean and what was happening on land was related? And I could never have, and I knew that the answer to that would be a fascinating story,
mm-hmm.
but I could never have realized at that time how true that would be.
We don't actually want to ask you directly about which parts of the book are true and factual and which parts are not, but perhaps we could talk a little bit about the extensive research that you did into this book and how that research found its way into the novel. For example, you describe in the afterword that you've been swimming with the whales. You've looked a whale in the eye, just as Elizabeth McCabe does in the excerpt that you read for us earlier. Could you perhaps tell us about that experience?
Absolutely. This book took the expertise of so many extraordinary minds and extraordinary scientists. I worked with many of the world's leading marine biologists and whale scientists, shark scientists, as well as ecotoxicologists, physicians, just an amazing group of people. And one of the joys of doing fact-based fiction is you get to work on the kind of edge of what we know. And so, for example, I worked with Roger Payne, who was the discoverer of whale song. He discovered that humpback whales actually sing structured songs similar to our structured songs. And so he was one of my fascinating advisors, and I actually got to go with a marine biologist down to Tonga, and I, was 20 minutes off this tiny puddle jumper plane that took me to this little island in Tonga, was in the water with the whales, and actually saw the scene that I, the setting of the scene that I just described here. I saw a humpback female with a newborn calf draped across his back, and an escort whale, which is a male whale, below. And the escort whale, when we got into the water and we were filming their behavior and recording song, when he saw me, came over, eyeballed me, and then raised his pectoral fin over my body to avoid knocking me out of the way. And if he hadn't chosen to do that, I wouldn't be on the line with you today.
My gosh. Were you scared?
I was quite scared. The whales are, they're enormous. And, that pectoral fin, thousands of pounds, and could definitely have knocked me unconscious right there. I also went cage diving with great white sharks at the Farallon Islands with a shark biologist, which was quite amazing. You have to follow the story where it goes. I will say that was a day at the office that my wife really wanted to know I was home from.
Mm-hmm. We'll mention for listeners, too, that there's a great white shark off the Farallons who figures prominently at the conclusion of the novel. And things do not work out. Elizabeth McKay has I just want to talk about her doctoral dissertation director from hell, a guy who gives her a really hard time throughout the novel. And so there's a little kerfuffle out there with the great white.
But you have to read it to find out what that kerfuffle is all about.
Yeah,
and what happens?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there are whales and sharks in the story, but I will say, one thing that's very important to me was that, the shark, this is not Jaws, and so sharks in this novel, are not, they may be frightening as sharks can be, but they are also majestic, and it's really important to remember how vital sharks are to our ecosystem. And the number of people who were killed by sharks last year is fewer than the number of people who were killed by toaster ovens in their kitchen and by coconuts. So it's just important, and on the other side, we have killed 110 million sharks last year.
Right, it's just...
And sharks are vilified also on reality TV. As somebody said, they throw raw meat in the water, put a diver in a cage, and... then the shark acts aggressive. Well, not surprising, and all for the sake of TV.
Well, exactly. We have Shark Week, of course, and so on Discovery, and then we have this fascination for the ocean and for the deep, and yet sometimes it's a bit superficial. And I think one of the things that I was hoping to do with Eye of the Whale is you really get this kind of eye to eye view of the ocean and of its magnificent creatures. So that was my hope, was really to take readers along with me into that extraordinary world.
Mm-hmm.
We want to ask you a little more about whale communication, but before we do that, let's listen to a short piece. This is from Songs from the Humpback Whale. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Doug Abrams about his novel, The Eye of the Whale, as we listen to the song of the humpback whale in the background. In your research for the book, Doug, you did a great deal of research into whale songs, whale communication. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you learned and where the research is going with whale communication?
Absolutely. It's really quite a fascinating field. And so in the novel, as I mentioned earlier, Elizabeth McKay, the main character, who's a marine biologist, is trying to crack the code of this humpback whale song and also its social sounds of the humpback whales. And just to make that distinction, the song is what you heard there. It is quite lyrical, mm-hmm. very evocative, mm-hmm. that haunting song, and in a very structured, repeated form. And social sounds are what we say to each other every day conversation. So if I said, Susan, Stephen, let's go get a beer after the show, that would be those would be the equivalent of social sounds. Mm-hmm. And for the whales, that might be, hey Bob, let's go get some krill. Mm-hmm. But one of the fascinating things, and we were hypothesizing in the novel that that there potentially could be social sounds in song. And as we were, as I was writing this, and I say we practically because I was working so closely with the scientists, they did find social sounds in song, which you can imagine what that means is it means there's the possibility. There could be lots of different meanings for the presence of social sounds in song, and so we still don't know, but it does make the possibility of lyrics. Raises the possibility of lyrics. So it might not just be all kind of saxophone jazz. It could actually be ballads that are being sung.
Mm-hmm. Right, that are communicating something very specific.
Yes, exactly.
So did you hear these songs? You got to hear these songs?
I did. I got to hear these songs and record the songs while I was working with the marine biologist Libby Iyer with the whales. And they're amazing. I mean, one of the things that the scientists say is, the whales make practically every song that sound that you can imagine in the animal kingdom. You know, sometimes they sound like dogs barking, sometimes they sound like elephants trumpeting. And so in many ways, in the novel, the whales are kind of the voice of nature, and they reflect that diversity and that, and of course, as you know, the book is very much of a kind of scientific detective story as Elizabeth is trying to decode and discover what these sounds might actually mean.
Right.
Well, changing gears just a little bit,
yep.
The lesions on the baby whale in the segment that you read for us turn out to be a significant clue. And your novel has what seems to us like a most unlikely theme of endocrine disruption.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that, please? How did it how did that come about and become incorporated in the book?
Sure. So one of the things that this book attempts to do, in addition to exploring the mysteries of the ocean, is also talking about the health of the environment. And really what we discover is it's all related to water. What happens in the ocean, what happens in the land, what happens in our bodies and our children's bodies, all related to water. And that was the connection that I was wondering about that morning. And what you discover is that by putting chemicals, industrial chemicals, and you mentioned plastic and the plastiki captain at the top of the hour, by particularly chemicals that are plastics, which look like estrogen often to our bodies, we end up changing our health and causing all sorts of toxic changes in our bodies. For example, we are causing more birth defects, more cancer. We're causing a whole host of infertility. For example, mm-hmm. one of the most glaring examples is in the water in the Potomac, where some of your listeners may have seen there was actually a program on. On the Colbert Report, mm-hmm. and he was had a New York Times reporter who was referencing some of the research that I also saw, where in the Potomac River, which is the water that is drunk in Washington, D.C., 80 to 100% of the smallmouth bass, depending on the site, the male smallmouth bass now have eggs.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Now, you know, as we all remember from our biology classes,
that's not right.
That's the males are not supposed to have the eggs. These are the kinds of fundamental changes. And endocrine disruption just means a change to our hormonal system. But what's so powerful about our hormones regulate everything from our mood to our fertility to our physiology, to whether we're a boy or a girl. And very minute quantities in the parts per billion can have dramatic impacts on the health of ourselves and our children.
And you talked with Pete Myers.
Yes, so Pete was one of my advisors, and brilliant. Pete Myers, the author of Our Stolen Future, he actually, many of the scientists kind of became models for some of the characters in the novel, inspired some of the characters, and Pete is just a brilliant scientist, unfortunately, when Pete read the manuscript, and I asked him, you know, am I, is the villainy too great in the novel? You know, in fiction, you need really compelling villains because your characters are only as strong as the forces of opposition they face. But as a father, I was hoping that my villains were just fictional, and unfortunately, Pete told me that the villainy I was describing in the novel really is what is happening in our world.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he spoke at our Chico State has a sustainability conference every autumn.
Oh,
and
great.
He spoke at our sustainability conference, and he was very impressive. I felt he was very convincing in presenting his data.
Yeah, Pete is the best. He's great. And he and Theo Colburn, who both wrote Our Stolen Future together with a journalist. That's a great book if you're looking for a non-fiction primer on this subject. And Theo Colburn is also a hero. And I had the joy of doing a radio show on Here and Now for NPR with Theo recently. And
nice.
It's great, yeah.
Another one of the subplots of your novel involves activists who go to Japan to dramatically protest Japanese whaling practices. And earlier in the show, before we started talking to you, we reviewed the international whaling ban and how that is circumvented in the name of scientific research by
yes.
several countries.
Yes.
Could you please tell us how that became part of your book?
Sure. Well, first off, dealing with whales in the novel, obviously whaling is one of the subjects that I needed to cover in the story. I went to Tonga in addition to working with a marine biologist. I went with a quite extraordinary photographer named Brian Austin, who is trying to create life-size images of whales to display in whaling nations, and has actually done that.
Wow.
Quite extraordinary work. And his efforts to try to humanize the whales, or I guess humanize is the wrong word because I was trying to anthropomorphize, but humanize
right.
us in understanding the whales, was an inspiration to me in working on that. And in writing the book, you know, all the characters have to be three-dimensional, so I had to go and meet with present-day whalers and learn their perspective, because everybody, you can't write a stump piece for any one position in fiction. You have to create characters with credible motivations and see how they interact. And I'd say one thing about that, actually, which is that one of my questions in writing this book was to try to find out if there's something in us that's stronger than our fear, our ignorance, and our greed. And there's really no better place to ask a question about human nature than in the fictional arena.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very much part of what I was longing for, was, you know, an answer to this very personal and universal question about what kind of a world we're going to be leaving to our children and whether there's something that's stronger than those forces that can hopefully prevail.
And speaking of forces, one of the things that happens in the novel is Elizabeth McKay winds up testifying before Congress, and here's another force that shapes what's going to happen in these environmental issues.
Yeah.
You acknowledge the work of Barbara Boxer and others in trying to address the environmental crises we face. What did you learn about those sorts of efforts in Congress, and what can government do, and what should government do?
Well, again, this is one of the fascinating things about writing fact-based fiction is you're writing about things often that are unfolding as we speak.
Uh-huh.
And there is actually a bill in Congress about that Theo Coburn has sponsored on endocrine disruption, which
right.
is absolutely that John Kerry,
right.
erstwhile presidential candidate, is sponsoring, and is absolutely vital so that we can find out kind of what is in our bodies and in our children. And then Barbara Boxer and Senator Lautenberg are sponsoring the Kid Safe Chemical Act, which is also hopefully going to bring some regulation and sanity to these issues. But because what many people don't realize is we've invented 80,000 industrial chemicals that we put into our environment over the last 50 years since World War II.
Crazy.
And we've only tested a fraction of them, and only then in isolation, but not in the
combination.
Large chemical cocktails that we are exposed to.
Yeah, that's one of Pete Meyer's arguments, too, that we test them separately, not in combination, and a lot of their effects are in combination.
Exactly. I mean, and one of the amazing things that you probably remember from Pete, that these chemicals can have profound effects on us in things in terms of things like, they call them now obesogens. They can lead to our being obese, or if we're stressed, these chemicals can have a greater effect on us. So we are these extraordinary ecosystems. We are mm-hmm. the sea inside of our body, and we are exposed to these, what it is that flows through our bodies affects that ecosystem.
Yeah.
We've done several programs on international efforts at saving the environment and ocean preservation and so forth. We did several on the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference, and like many people, were somewhat disappointed with the results or non-results from that.
Sure.
Have you had an opportunity to look at global efforts at preserving oceans and the climate? Do you have any good news for us or thoughts about the directions that global regulation might take?
Well, the Obama administration, for the first time, has created an ocean task force. And Jane Lubchenco, who's the head of NOAA, who actually, to my delight, received a copy of the book, is doing really good work in trying to consider the oceans as this vital national resource and international global resource. The problem is, the oceans are this tragedy of the commons where everything, where everyone feels that they can strip mine it of fish and, mm-hmm. And pollute, dump anything they want into it, and it's nobody's responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some good work, at least on our national shores, that's happening and the oceans that affect us. Obviously, there are these enormous tragedies like in the Gulf that we have to contend with. But I do think also that has brought people's attention to realizing the fragility of our oceans. And I think there are, one of the very hopeful things that I learned in writing this book is that, there is so much doom and gloom in when you work with environmental issues, because there is, unfortunately, so much destruction that's going on. But one of the hopeful things that you discover in the book, and that I discovered in my research, is actually so much of the suffering and disease that we take as inevitable is actually human-made. And by making different choices about what we put into the environment, we can end a lot of that suffering.
So I'm curious that you're a novelist, you're an activist, you're a researcher. In writing a novel is your primary goal to create a call to action, or is your goal to inspire or entertain, maybe all of the above?
Well, it's a great question, I mean, my goal is, as a novelist, is obviously first and foremost to entertain with a good story. Because if people aren't turning pages, then they're not, and they're not engaged, then there won't be anything else that they get out of it. One of the pleasures of working in the genre that I worked in for this novel is that it really is about the world, and it's about issues that matter to us and that demand our awareness. But one of the joys of fiction as opposed to nonfiction, or about a story as opposed to a protest march or a lobbying effort, is that stories spark our imagination. We are story dwellers. We live in stories. Mm-hmm. And by having a story that sheds light on what all these different facts and news reports that we hear about and studies that we hear about, by tying it all together in a story, it allows us to see the world in a new way. And I think that as a novelist, it's really about understanding character. It's about understanding humanity. It's about discovering our relationship to the natural world and finding our way back into a true relationship with the world around us.
Great answer.
Indeed. With those insights, I know a number of our listeners will get a copy of the book and read it. If they are inspired, which I suspect they will be, how can listeners become involved in some of the issues discussed in Eye of the Whale, either endocrine disruption or whaling bans or the health of the oceans generally?
Yeah, there are. On my website, which is douglascarltonabrams.com, I have a list of some of the hero organizations that people can find, as well as actually a discussion of all the facts in the book. And some in particular that are quite extraordinary, the Ocean Alliance and the Ocean Conservancy are two great organizations that are working for the welfare of our seas and our own health as a result of those. In terms of some of the environmental toxicity issues, Environmental Working Group is an excellent organization. But there are so many good organizations, it really becomes the Sea Shepherd and Greenpeace are doing good work in terms of whaling. There's actually a consortium of groups who are talking about, called the Whales Need Us, which is talking about how we haven't quite saved the whales yet and some mm-hmm. of the threats that exist to whales. So there are lots of great groups out there.
So this sounds like kind of an all-consuming life project. What's your next project? It sounds like you still have kind of ideas about this going, but
yeah,
where will you go next?
Well, the paperback is just coming out at the end of next month.
Okay.
I'm going to be still happily in the conversation of this
nice.
Book. I have the joy of not being a writer who can, I don't have to quite write on deadline, you know, a book a year or a couple every 2 years. I can write the books that move me deeply. And my books all come out of this profound question that I need to know the answer to for desperately. And this one, as I mentioned, was about what is stronger than ignorance, fear, and greed. And you know, and when the next question occurs, that's when I'll be off to writing the next book.
Nice.
Thank you. We've been talking with Douglas Carlton Abrams. He's author of Eye of the Whale. It's published by Atria Books. That's a division of Simon & Schuster. You can learn more about him and his work at www.douglascarltonabrams.com and also at simonandschuster.com. Plus, we've posted those links on our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. Delightful conversation, Doug. Thank you very much for being with us.
My great pleasure.
Thank you.
To you both.
Nice. Good night.
Take care. Good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
are listening to Who Is She? Song for the Whales by Petra Hayden and Woody Jackson from 10 Years. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we've been talking about issues surrounding the health of the global whale population with important implications for human health as well.
Earlier in the program, we mentioned the work of the National Resources Defense Council fighting efforts to compromise the international whale hunting ban. NRDC also has a broader aim of saving the world's ocean health and, in fact, the Earth itself. Their website is a great resource for information on threats to the seas and sea creatures. NRDC also has an excellent action page.